You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Dottie Addy. She's an artist that lives and works in New York City. Dottie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Brainerd.
Let's talk about your work. I of course, know the history of your work, which is very impressive, and in a way, so much has changed, over the course of your work, and so much has remained the same in terms of your stylistic approach. But I'd like to talk today a little bit about the series Worst Case Scenario, which I believe is at PPOW. Is that the gallery that represents
yeah.
you now?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay. So can we talk a little bit about that series and how you began it and what some of the intentions were behind it? It's quite small, right? All the canvases are 6 by 6 inches. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. Actually, I guess in a way, all of my work is a worst-case scenario. And my work is 6 by 6 inches square, every painting. Usually, I make a series, and I combine the images with text, and I can have as many as, 100 images, to make one work. Or I can have two. But in worst-case scenarios, I decided that I would just have one or two with the text simply being worst-case scenario. I did what I always do when I want to start a new group of paintings. I get out my trusty photography books, of which I have many, many, and I just start looking at images and, sort of see what appeals to me. And then I mark them, and then I scan them into my computer, and then I paint them. Worst case scenarios seem to me like so perfect to do works that would stand on their own. I generally don't think like that, but in this case I was able to, and it's rewarding. And actually I sort of want to go back to it at some point. Right now I'm doing a group of paintings on the radio, I would like to go back to worst-case scenarios at some point.
Well, let's talk about the paintings you're doing now then, that you just mentioned, and perhaps we'll go back to also talking a little bit more about worst-case scenarios, the worst-case scenario series. What paintings are you working on right now?
They're paintings about radio, and there's two groups of them. One is people performing on the radio, and the other is people listening to the radio. And I think radio, like so many things, is something that definitely changed the world. And, a lot of regional music, sort of disappeared after the radio, but people got much more information on the radio, information that really wasn't available before. So I have images of people from all different countries listening to the radio, groups of people listening to the radio, one person listening to the radio, plus a lot of beloved and not so beloved figures performing on the radio. And I don't know what the text will be, actually. I have no idea right now.
Not to date you, but the radio is something that also you saw come alive in your time. I mean, you were...
I did indeed.
But then after that, as you grew up, you were people literally... I imagine people sitting around radio.
Oh, absolutely. We had a big radio in our living room. And after dinner, we would go into the living room. My father would read a book but also listen. My mother would be sewing or doing something like that and listening. And I was always listening. I loved the radio, actually. And on Saturday mornings, I would listen to the whole lineup, Let's Pretend, and
Well, in a way, it's nothing like, you know, many mediums now, because though I didn't really grow up experiencing that the same way, it was a completely visual medium in a sense, because you had to imagine all these things, sounds.
Yeah.
And
right, you were always imagining it. And at one point, I went to hear or see a radio show, and, you know, I can't really remember what it was exactly, but it was totally different from what I had thought of. I mean, I had just made up all these images, and here were, you know, like two or three people in front of microphones, and whenever, you know, a horse was coming by, somebody would come and, you know, click, and, you know, all the sounds were made by one of the people, and it just, you know, it just boggled my mind, but I loved it all the same.
So to go back a little bit to the worst-case scenario images, which I've been looking through a lot and are interesting because, to me, they seem in a way different from your other work in a sense. Like you're saying, they don't have the same kind of text and they're using very few images. But they're very powerful and very disturbing, difficult to look at some of them. And the narratives in them aren't always so apparent in what's happening. You know, these images of the Klan or of men and women. I kind of want to talk about the content of some of these and what you were after, or if you don't want to speak about it that directly, what some of the reaction to this work is, or what it elicits from people, the kind of conversations that come from this.
You know, that I didn't have many conversations about it. You know, people didn't really. People would tell me they did feel disturbed. They thought they were disturbing. I mean, that's sort of my goal in all of my work, is for it to be kind of disturbing, and also for people to fill in the stories. Even though I combine it with text, I generally try to leave gaps between the text and the images so that, you know, the viewer really has to dig into his own psyche, his or her own psyche, and, you know, sort of make the story cohesive, more cohesive than it would be. And that's the same with worst-case scenarios. I mean, in some cases, I mean, I thought I might do, although I didn't have time to, unfortunately, I thought I might do something called best-case scenarios and have some of the same images, because it really depends on who it's all happening to, you know, how bad it is or what your viewpoint is.
And by best-case scenario, you mean having actually the very same images but titling them something different?
Them best-case scenarios, you know. For example, I had an image of a little dog in a handbag. For the dog, I think it probably wasn't too great, you know. But for the owner, it was very convenient.
Right. Well, or the one of somebody being, you know, in injected. You know, one man
right.
giving another man an injection.
Yeah.
You know, you know, when I look at that as worst case scenarios, and they all have different feelings to me, but that one looks scary somehow to me. But in the best case scenario, he's getting a vaccination, right?
Right. He's getting something, you know, that'll cure him from God knows what he might have.
Right. Or giving it to him, one way or the other. I mean, since you've had this career of making work that is disturbing, do you find that there is few conversations about that in general? I mean, you've always, you know, had a solid career and continual shows, And it's I think it's true that we don't see that much work that's still like that. You know, I interviewed Ida Applebrew not long ago, and of course she's always made work that's disturbing as well, but has been doing that for a long time. Is there conversations at all that you've had regarding your work about the idea of disturbing material and what that brings out of people as they view it or collect it or
I think maybe they're afraid to talk to me about it. Not really. I mean, people don't, you know, they'll say to me maybe, wow, you know, that's really odd or that's really weird, you know. But they won't say, you know, why do you do work like this? I mean, not that I would have an answer for that. I don't really know. I don't, you know, surprisingly enough, I don't really have a lot of conversations about it. I did do a piece which was in, not my last show, but I think the show before that, and it was called Hitler Light. And it showed, it was three images of Hitler, and one was him sort of with a big smile on his face inspecting a Volkswagen car. One was him looking at a painting. And one was him with two women on his, you know, on each arm. And my dealers, Penny and Wendy, said, oh, we'll never sell this. And I said, I know, you'll never sell that. But they did sell it. I couldn't believe it. So there's, you know, there are people who are, as I am, you know, attracted to the bizarre and uncomfortable.
And maybe it's part of that that they don't talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, the person, the collector who bought that didn't talk about why they bought it or anything like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe they don't want to really confront it too directly. You know, what about it is attractive.
And if people did ask you, why do you paint these things? You why do you paint work that's disturbing as opposed to something that would be the opposite?
I don't really know. As I said, that's always interested me. You know, like weird, bizarre things have always interested me. You know, from earliest childhood. And that's what I feel most interested in painting and working on. I mean, I try to make my paintings, you know, as likable as possible in the sense, you know, that I try to paint them really carefully and beautifully. And, but, you know, the subject matter is definitely weird.
And it was always like that. I mean, to me, I don't know whether it's a statement of where we're at, and I can talk about the specifics of some of these images, but even early in your career, people weren't talking more about what was happening. I mean, is that at all an indication of our times? Or earlier in your career, were people talking more about disturbing issues, or in Europe or anywhere else, do they talk more about that?
Well, you know, I started out showing at AIR Gallery. I was actually one of the first six members. And at that point, people tended, and it was an all-women's gallery, and people tended to see my work somehow as feminist, you know, that I was making a statement, I guess, against men or whatever, which I never felt. I mean, I always feel my work is psychological, doesn't have really a feminist agenda, but although I am a feminist. So somehow that was the conversation more, you know, that I was a feminist, you know, showing at AIR, an all-women's gallery, and doing work that somehow was all about my anger. And it is about my anger, I guess. but it's not about feminist anger. It's just about anger.
Hmm.
I'm not an angry person if you meet me, though.
Well, most people who say they're angry don't seem to me. I interviewed two curators recently who said, really, they're angry artists. You know, they wanted to be an artist and they felt that they couldn't be, or that the world prevented them from being, or something. And so they said, like so many, we're curating and feel good about curating, but also see themselves as angry artists to some extent. So let's just talk about three images, because to me they're very different. One is one that's also from the Worst Case Scenario series, and it's one woman spanking another woman, or it looks like she's about to, which is, you know, to me looks like kind of an erotic image or pulled from images that were about that.
I have a lot of books of erotic photography, yeah.
I mean, there's been elements of that in your past work, but the reason I want to talk about these three images is because they all seem quite different to me in how they're talking about subject matter and narratives here. And I suppose on one level, this, you know, now that we've talked about anger, this, you know, could be about anger, you know. I mean, I remember being spanked. It was a traumatic experience for me as a child, and it was about anger. But this has kind of a mixed feeling also of it being kind of erotic. And was that your intention in
yes,
creating it?
It was my intention, actually. You know, I wanted it to be like a slightly, like a kind of a naughty photograph, a naughty painting, sorry. It just attracted me. You know, I saw it, I liked it, I felt it was, I don't try to analyze too much what it is that draws me to something, because I feel that I don't want my work to be about ideas so much as about feelings, and it just had a feeling, you know, an intriguing feeling for me.
Hmm. Okay, the other work that certainly has an intriguing feeling for me is The Lone Ranger. Which feels, you know, upsetting to me. It feels like, you know, all of these have a look to me, and I don't know why that is, but of an era like the 50s or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it feels like it's about racism or subservience or something like that, and is... it is kind of a bizarre image as well. But as much as there's a feeling about it, I'm also, like, bringing a narrative to it. Does that, do you think that's appropriate, and is that what you expect from something like
that? Well, The Lone Ranger, actually, that was not part of the Worst Case Scenarios. That was part of The Lone Ranger. So I did five groups of paintings all about the Lone Ranger. And, and one reason that I use old photographs and not current ones is because of the subject matter. I like to have a kind of a barrier between me and the subject matter, since the subject matter is usually taboo subject matter. Although I have to say it's getting harder and harder to find something shocking. But The Lone Ranger, so I did a group of paintings of the imitators of The Lone Ranger, in which I just used faces with all kinds of masks. You know, they were sort of the failed imitators of The Lone Ranger. And then there were the fans of The Lone Ranger, where everybody was wearing a mask like The Lone Ranger does. And then there was just The Lone Ranger, lots of different images of The Lone Ranger. And what were the other two? I can't even remember. But
well, that makes sense in that context. And also, you know, though I had that title in front of me, The Lone Ranger, when looking at it, that does, in a sense, kind of insert a narrative into it then.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
then
definitely. There definitely was a narrative, although it was unlike my usual work, but it's been true of the last few years. The work I've done has had much less text. So this, The Lone Ranger, although, you know, there were maybe 30 paintings, there was only two text panels, like one sentence broken up. Pretty much.
Hmm.
I think that was what it was.
Well, and the, another one from the Lone Ranger series was what looks like Klansmen in masks holding, I'm not sure what it is. It doesn't look like a cross, but it looks like one of those.
Oh, yeah. That was actually the worst case scenario one.
Oh, that was worst?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that one also has kind of a
yeah.
I mean, that's very disturbing to me and hard to look at, and would seem also like a painting that wouldn't be very saleable, because I think for everyone those kind of images, much like
yeah.
Hitler, are very
right.
difficult.
I don't think that one did get sold, as a matter of fact. But yeah, I don't actually even think it was the Klan. But it looked very much like the Klan.
Well, because
so
they're holding something in their hand that looks almost like a flower. So it,
yeah,
that
I never could figure out what that was. Right, it just seemed, you know, very enigmatic and strange and related to the Klan. Although, as I said, I don't think it was an image of the Klan. But just maybe some kind of a parade or something.
And in the course of, I mean, you've gone through, you know, so many different things, but in the course of working and selling with a gallery like PPOW, is there certain subject matter that you find sells better than others? Is and I know that's something that probably wouldn't influence how you're working, but I would think that
unfortunately,
that
it doesn't influence how I work. Sometimes I wish it would. I found, actually, I did one group of paintings. Everything had the same text. You know, like there were, I think, 10 groups of paintings. They all had the same text, but they were all on completely different themes. Like one was about, you know, justice and crime. One was about having people over for dinner. One was about war. They were just really totally different, but the text was exactly the same in those.
And were those
and
something...
those sold really well? Yeah, one was about raising children, I remember. Yeah. I think I sold almost every one of those.
And why do you think that was? Because they were less disturbing, or?
I don't really know. I don't know why that was, actually.
It's interesting. And so, and that's never persuaded you to make more of that. You continue to evolve and change in your direction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it wouldn't be interesting. I really believe that, you know, as an artist, you're really privileged to do what you love, you know, for your whole life, which is really something great. It's great. But if you don't love it anymore, what's the point of doing it? And, you know, so if I just was doing what I, you know, I thought would sell, I think I would get really bored.
Hmm. Well, and let's talk a little bit about being a feminist as you defined it, because of course AIR was a very, very important gallery and moment in history that you were so closely involved in. And as you said, your paintings, though associated initially with that gallery, aren't necessarily feminist works or speaking to a feminist agenda, but you are a feminist. How do you define that for yourself now, being a feminist?
How do I define being a feminist? I think being a feminist is feeling free to live exactly the life you want to live. You know, and not feeling constrained by, you know, other people's expectations of you, or your own expectations, you know, of what you should be doing instead of what you want to be doing.
I mean, that's changed over time, right? The definition of different generations of feminists have changed. How do you see that evolution, or what do you think is happening in terms of the movement, if there is one, or the definition of feminism?
Well, I think, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, it was really new. You know, there have always been feminists. I don't mean that. But I mean, the idea that every woman should be a feminist was an idea that needed to be put across to everybody, including women. And so it was sort of different. I think there was a much more active agenda for women who felt like they wanted to be feminine. They were feminists and wanted the rest of the world to also be feminists. I think now so much has changed. You know, women have careers, or at least jobs at the very least. You know, there are so few women that stay at home and take care of their kids. The women are just much more independent now. And I think the need for activism, while it hasn't gone away, is less than it was before. I think, you know, with every succeeding generation, it gets to be less and less, you know. Hopefully, it gets to be less and less.
Yeah, hopefully it does. Hopefully history teaches us something, right? And we all learn from that.
Hopefully, yeah. Well, look at the difference, you know. Look at how homophobia has changed in a really short time. And I think it has a lot to do with the AIDS crisis and TV, you know, people seeing, and people, you know, people coming out and act up, you know. It's kind of amazing.
Well, I'm excited that we talked. I really enjoyed talking with you, and in looking to the future of what you're doing, will the work you're doing on now be shown at PPOW ultimately?
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly the plan. When it's finished enough, you know, I'll tell them I want to have a show, and they'll tell me, you know, what's open, and I'll choose. That's what I generally do. But yes, definitely.
Dottie, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Brainerd. It's been a great pleasure for me, too.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.